A very big welcome to the Anxiety Summit Season 2. This is your host, Trudy Scott. I'm a certified nutritionist, a food mood expert, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. And today I'm interviewing Julie Matthews, certified nutrition consultant, and our topic is fermented foods and probiotics for anxiety and depression, the practical and the research. A very, very big welcome, Julie. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Trudy. I'm really glad to be here.
It's really nice to have you back on Season 2. If any one of you are listening who tuned into Season 1, you'll remember Julie's fabulous talk, Bio-Individual Nutrition for Anxiety, how special diets and avoiding certain foods can support individuals with anxiety. It was so popular, and Julie is such a wealth of knowledge that I decided to invite her back for a totally new topic, and this is going to be fermented foods. And Julie's amazing how she does this great job of meshing the practical with the research, so you're in for a real treat today. Let me read your bio, and then we'll get started. Julie Matthews is a certified nutrition consultant specializing in autism spectrum disorders, ADHD, and nutrition for pregnancy. Her approach is based on the bio-individual nutrition needs of each person. She provides dietary guidance based on scientific research and applied clinical experience. Her award-winning book, Nourishing Hope for Autism, has helped people around the world to make food and nutrition choices that aid the health, learning, and behavior of those with autism, ADHD, and other developmental delays. She presents at leading autism conferences in the U.S. and abroad and is the nutrition editor of the Autism File magazine. She's also on the scientific advisory board for the Autism and Asperger, U.S. Autism and Asperger Association and the Autism Nutrition Research Center. She's co-founder of Nourishing Hope and Bio-Individual Nutrition Institute. Julie has a private nutrition practice in San Francisco, California, and supports families and clinicians from around the world with her nutrition learning tools and professional training courses. You can visit nourishinghope.com and bioindividualnutrition.com. What I'd like to do is just read a short section from an abstract that was published this year, and the co-author is actually Dr. Ted Dynan, who created this term called psychobiotics when he was talking about the beneficial effects that probiotics can actually have when it comes to mood. And what this paper says is that there is increasing evidence that host-microbe interactions play a key role in maintaining homeostasis. Alterations in gut microbial composition is associated with marked changes in behaviors relevant to mood, pain, and cognition, establishing the critical importance of the bidirectional pathway of communication between the microbiota and the brain in health and disease. Dysfunction of the microbiome brain-gut axis has been implicated in stress-related disorders such as depression, anxiety, and irritable bowel syndrome, and neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism. And you'll notice that this mentions anxiety and depression and autism. And Julie's expertise is in nutrition for autism, but we're finding that there's many factors that play a role in autism and also play a role in anxiety and depression. And I just want to share that what she covers in her wonderful book, Nourishing Hope for Autism, her programs, her Cooking to Heal DVD, have a much broader application than only autism. And, of course, the Bio-Individual Nutrition Institute is just that. It's teaching you how to address each person's unique biochemistry with food and nutrients. So this is just one of 50 papers on probiotics, the microbiome, and the connection between the microbiome and anxiety. We've found 14 papers just published this year. So it's clearly an important topic, and I know Julie's going to share some more research as we go through all of this. So let's get started with our interview, Fermented Foods and Probiotics for Anxiety and Depression, the Practical and the Research. Let's get started with what a fermentation is and what are the different types of fermented foods and beverages that we would see out there. Julie?
Sure. So there are a number of different types of ferments. So there's ferments where good bacteria ferments grains and makes things like bread, sourdough breads and things like that. But for the purpose of our conversation today, we're going to talk about live lactobacillus and other types of ferments that are going to help colonize the good bacteria in our gut. And so when we're talking about those types of ferments, those are things like raw sauerkraut, different types of yogurt. Most people, the most common one that people are familiar with is yogurt. And so yogurt is going to have lactobacillus acidophilus and a variety of other good probiotics that we need. And so that's the one that most people are most familiar with. Now, many of the strains that are on the market today are pasteurized and don't actually contain live strains, but you can find them, and that is actually how they are originally and specifically made, is by the culturing of milk with a variety of different strains of good bacteria. There's also different types of beverages, kombucha, kefirs, and things like that as well.
Okay, great. So if someone had an issue with dairy, then they could choose a non-dairy option.
Absolutely, and that's a lot of what I do, because a lot of the people that I work with don't tolerate dairy.
Okay. And then I want to just make some clarification here, because you can go and buy yogurt in the store and it may sound like it's good, but it's not really going to be that great. So what would we need to look for if we are buying yogurt in the store?
Well, you're going to want to look for something that typically says live cultures. That's typically for a yogurt, that's usually what is going to be on the label. For something like a sauerkraut, you might look for something that either says raw, unpasteurized, live cultures, something like that.
Okay. And then the other thing with yogurt is we want to think about is a lot of yogurts are loaded up with sugar, and we wouldn't want to be getting something that is, you know, high in sugar and certainly not something that's low fat.
Right, exactly. So we want to be careful. In fact, even today, sad to say, you have to be careful about the artificial additives that might be in it, the artificial colors or flavors or sweeteners or things like that. So unfortunately, you really do want to read the label, and you want to look for something that's all natural and is going to be in its natural state.
Okay, great. Or make your own, and we're going to talk about some of that towards the end of the call. So
Absolutely. Making
your own ferments are going to be a great option.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get right into the benefits of good bacteria and these probiotics. Why do we want to incorporate this into our diets?
Well, so these, you know, as you mentioned, these fermented foods contain live probiotics, and that's one of the main benefits. It also does things and helps to break down our food so it's more easily digestible. But along with that, we want all the benefits that the good bacteria are going to supply as we consume them and colonize our intestinal system. And so there are many types of important functions that they play. So everything from helping keeping our bowels moving so that we are able to have nice regulated bowel movements, to making sure that they are making certain vitamins that we need, B vitamins, vitamin K, things like that. They actually help to break down environmental toxins and other things that we might be exposed to. They produce a variety of antibiotic and antifungal properties. They help us to digest and break down our nutrients so we can have better access to them. They're really important for our immune system. They're important for intestinal health. And they, there are just dozens, well, probably hundreds of different functions that this good bacteria plays in our body. And actually, that's why it's so essential. In fact, if you think about it, one of the first things on this planet was bacteria. And so we, as humans, evolved synergistically in an environment that was filled with bacteria. And these bacteria actually are very vital to our actual existence. And so they actually help us to be healthy. And without them, we wouldn't be.
Great. And if we are, so we're talking about the good bacteria that we might see in some of these fermented foods, and then we're also possibly talking about probiotic supplements. And I know we're going to go into probiotics a little bit later, but whether we're getting it from food or whether we're getting it from supplements, we're potentially getting all of these benefits.
Yes. You know, there are different benefits to different ones, I think, but in reality, it's the probiotics themselves. And so there are people that do supplements, and there are people that do it in fermented food form, and they actually have different benefits, but they all are beneficial.
Great. And I know you've got this lovely Nourishing Hope food pyramid, and fermented foods are a big part of that.
Absolutely. So at the bottom of the so I have a food pyramid that I created because I don't work with just one diet. I work with a variety of different diets. And so when we're looking at the different diets, you know, I try to figure out, well, what is really the foundation of all of it? And so I have a Nourishing Hope food pyramid that kind of helps you apply good food and nutrition and nutrient-dense foods to any different special diet that you might be on. And so at the very bottom of my pyramid are a variety of different foundational principles that help to make the foods more nutrient-dense and more digestible and to make us healthier. And so one of those principles is fermentation.
Okay, great. And I want to just clarify that this food pyramid is very different from the other food pyramid that we may know about.
Absolutely. So it's actually almost opposite of it. It really sort of turns the normal food pyramid we think of kind of upside down. And instead of having a large number of servings of grain products and often gluten grain products, it has no gluten, and the grains are at the smallest portion of the pyramid itself, if someone's going to consume them at all.
Okay, great. And then give me some examples of things that we might see at the bottom of the pyramid, meaning we want to eat more of those.
For me, the foundation of the pyramid are good quality non-starchy vegetables and good quality protein. And typically that protein includes animal protein as a foundation, because those animal protein is going to have all the essential amino acids and a whole bunch of good fatty acids and fat-soluble vitamins and things that we really need for good health. So to me, that's at the kind of core or the foundation of the pyramid.
Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying that. Now, other things that we need to think about when it comes to gut health is yeast, and then possibly an overgrowth of bad bacteria or parasites. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So, you know, we need that good bacteria for our health, and it does many good things. One of the things that I didn't even really mention yet, that you mentioned early on in the study, was that good bacteria can also help with sending signals to the brain and helping us with good mood. Well, the opposite is true for pathogens. Pathogens can cause disease. They can cause us to have nutrient imbalances. They can affect the health of the gut and the absorption of nutrients, and they actually can create a variety of mood types of conditions: anxiety, depression, foggy thinking. Even, you know, there's a condition called TANDAs, which is a reaction, sort of an autoimmune reaction to certain strep strains. And one of the pretty well-known symptoms of that is OCD. So we see how a variety of different pathogens can actually not only harm us physically, but can also harm us with mood and our mental function as well.
Great. So what we've got is, if we've got this imbalance and we don't have the good flora, then we could have an overgrowth of the yeast, or we could have parasites getting out of control, or some of the bad bacteria getting out of control, causing inflammation, affecting digestion, absorption. And, you know, we need to really go back to basics and say that a lot of health problems begin in the gut, and this is a really big area that we need to focus on.
Absolutely, very much. It's important to look at the whole microbiome and how it all comes together, and to look at all the different factors that would be at play for our overall health.
Okay.
Trudy, I have a question, and I know this is sort of not related to our webinar, but I don't remember at the beginning of our webinar if we actually started the recording for everybody on the line with us. Do you remember if we did that?
We did.
Okay. Just making sure. I want to make sure everybody gets all our good information. All right, keep going.
Okay, good. We'll just cut that piece out.
Okay.
So when it comes to looking at probiotics and mood for both anxiety and depression, there is so much research supporting this. It's an emerging area of research. We're just seeing more and more and more research. I mentioned Timothy Dynan, and he's a researcher from Ireland. He's just doing so much research. And you've got some great studies to share on this connection between good bacteria and mood and some other factors that can affect us when it comes to mood problems. So can we start talking about some of those?
Absolutely. As you said, there were well over, there's papers coming out every day and every year on this subject. And so I just picked out a few that I thought would highlight some of this for us. There was a paper that came out in 2013 in Trends in Neurosciences, and that was by a team including Jane Foster. And it really talks about, in fact, the title of it says it all, really, which is Gut-Brain Axis, How the Microbiome Influences Anxiety and Depression. And so it really talks a lot about that connection. And so, you know, that's a really good study for people to look at if they want to get a better sense of how this can influence anxiety and depression. And then there was a really interesting study that they did in 2010 on the effects of probiotics, particularly Bifidobacterium infantis in the maternal separation model of depression. And this was a really interesting study done in, it was in Neuroscience, and it was by a researcher named Desbonnet, I think. I'm not exactly sure the pronunciation of their name. But it was a mouse study, and it was a little sad, actually. So the mice were separated from their mom, and they were asked to do this sort of swimming, like swimming against their will, I guess. So they, you know, they were looking at the stress response of all of this and whether they got sort of depressed or whether they got motivated to swim during the state of stress that they were in. And when they looked at the one group of mice were given this particular bacteria that's typically found in infants, which is this Bifidobacterium infantis, and found that the ones that received the probiotic had normalization of their immune response. They had reversal of some of the behavioral deficits that some of the other mice had. They had restoration of the noradrenaline concentrations in their brain stem, and they had increased motivation in the face of all of this. So I thought that was another really interesting study showing, you know, the importance of these probiotics when we're in various states, including states of stress. There was another study that was also done in that kind of state of stress, and it was looking at human subjects under academic stress and the effects of fermented yogurt, particularly Lactobacillus casei, which is a culture found in yogurt. And it was done in the European Journal of Nutrition in 2004 by a researcher named Marcos and their team. And so they found that the fermented yogurt was able to modulate the immune effects in the subjects that were under stress. So a combination of, you know, when we're under stress, our immune system goes down, or it can, and we get certain markers that show up. And so with the yogurt, even when they were under the state of stress, their immune system stayed stable rather than having the negative effects of it. So we're seeing a lot of good things. And we all know that stress can have profound impact on our mental state and our adrenals and our function and our immune system. And it can not only affect our health, but also our mental state too. Inflammation is really at the core of depression and some of these conditions as well. So I thought that was a very interesting study.
Very great. And that's wonderful that it was a human study and it was looking at yogurt. And I actually came across another study when I was getting ready for this, and this was a study done in Japan, and it was, what is the paper? I can't think what the, I don't have the actual paper here, but we'll make sure that we share all of these on the blog and in the on the replay page. But this particular study was looking at pregnant Japanese women, and they found that a higher intake of yogurt and calcium were independently related to lower prevalence of depressive symptoms during pregnancy. So again, we're seeing how, you know, food with these good bacteria can actually make a difference.
Absolutely. There was a study done by a researcher named Tillishk, and she did a study and that she published in 2013 in Gastroenterology in that journal. And, you know, we know a lot about how, of course, the brain sends signals to the gut, but she was explaining that in the study they learned that the gut also sends signals to the brain, and the researchers found that with yogurt, they found positive effects on the brain in many areas of the brain, including sensory processing and those associated with emotion and mood and things like that. So there are a lot of really great studies on anxiety, depression, mood, stress, all of that. And I thought I would throw in just a couple studies on autism because I think it's really important to see how important this gut is. And, you know, people with autism often have anxiety and depression, and they often have a whole host of other neurological challenges. So, you know, there's a number of studies that show things like children with autism have different beneficial bacteria and different strains of pathogens that don't show up in other places. So Jim Adams did a study in BMC gastroenterology and in 2011 and found that not only do they have children with autism have much lower levels of bifidobacterium, and they had their gastrointestinal symptoms were strongly correlated with the severity of their autism. So the more gastrointestinal symptoms they had, the greater severity of autism that they had. And there are a number of other studies showing that as well, you know, studies showing that, you know, diarrhea and colitis, along with a whole host of other medical diagnoses of asthma and eczema and all sorts of things, are present in people with autism. So autism is not just a brain condition. It's really a whole body condition where there are many ways that the body is dealing with either inflammation or problems, and very specifically how when they had increased gastrointestinal symptoms, the ones that had the worst gastrointestinal symptoms had the worst symptoms of autism. And that we know a lot about, like I said, that they have different strains of bad pathogenic bacteria that don't show up in the population at large, and much lower levels of good bacteria. So I just thought that that was interesting to throw in for those people that are out there that are kind of curious about other ways that people might be affected by their microbiome in terms of their cognitive function, their behavior, and mood as well.
Really great, and I'm glad you did that because it's your area of expertise, and as you said earlier, there's a lot of overlaps between causes of autism and then causes of anxiety and depression, and everyone's unique, so different things may affect different people in different ways.
Absolutely.
And then I've got one more that I wanted to throw out there. And as you can hear, there's a lot of research in this area, which is really, really exciting. This is an older paper. It was actually published in 2009 by Rayo and his colleagues. And they looked at people with chronic fatigue syndrome. So here we've got another condition other than anxiety and depression or autism. And they found that this imbalance in intestinal bacteria supports this gut-brain-mood connection, and that those treated with probiotics not only had a greater number of beneficial bacteria, but they also had a significant decrease in anxiety and depression. So we are seeing more and more, and it's pretty exciting. It really is exciting. And we certainly appreciate all the researchers doing this study because we know how beneficial these foods are, but seeing this research supporting it is really, really exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's very important.
Yeah. And you so and in I terms like, of you and I yeah. like to we lack the research part. So
Yes. I think it's important. I mean, you know, we see things in clinical practice, and you hear parents and individuals online talking a lot about it. But, you know, and to me, that is a level of important evidence that we need to gather, but it's also important to have the scientific evidence as well, because we can, you know, look at things much more specifically that way and, you know, make new connections and important discoveries.
Absolutely. Yeah. Are we ready to talk about probiotic supplements?
Sure, let's do that.
Okay.
There are a lot of different types of probiotics, and I thought, you know, maybe as we get into it, I actually just came across a bunch of research on a particular brand of probiotics. I mean, there's a lot of brands. There are a lot of really good ones, but I found a few studies on a probiotic called VSL3. Again, not every probiotic's right for every person, and I'm not here to plug the particular one, but I literally just came across several of them today. And one of them was talking about how this probiotic was used to modulate the intestinal microbiota of elderly people or conditions associated with brain gene expression and ameliorating the age-related deficits in neuronal function, basically. And so it's another kind of good study that shows us how this microbiome is going to relate to our brain function. And so I just thought, and this was actually, some of the other studies I mentioned were on yogurt or other fermentations. This one was actually on probiotics or a particular type of probiotic. And then what's also interesting in the last summit that you did where I spoke about bioindividual diets and I spoke quite a bit about oxalates and the low oxalate diet, which is an area that I specialize in and I find really fascinating, this actually specific probiotic was used to help with a variety of things, but particularly looking at the reduction in the gut absorbing oxalates. So the oxalate shouldn't, I mean, the gut shouldn't necessarily absorb oxalate. That good bacteria should break down the oxalate. That oxalate can cause a lot of inflammation. It can affect the individual mitochondria and cellular function. And as we talked about in the last summit, it can create anxiety and other things like that. And this particular probiotic was used showing a reduction in oxalate being absorbed from the gut. So that was, I thought, a really interesting, helpful study on a specific type of probiotic.
Very interesting. So this is the VSL3 probiotic that helps
yes.
with the oxalate absorption.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Yes.
And this was a human study.
It was.
Very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you happen to know what the strains are in this VSL3? And is it very high, or is it just that they happen to be doing
It's very high. It's very high strain. It's a very high. It's like 200 billion CFUs, I think. I think 200 to 400 billion. It's a very high potency probiotic. It's often a prescription-based probiotic. It contains many of the lactobacillus strains and a few other strains. It's mostly in that family, which is interesting because the actual bacteria that is known to break down oxalate is actually Oxalobacter firmigenes, and that's not in this probiotic. It appears that not only that one probiotic that was really named after that, which we know it does a great job at, but even these other probiotics are helpful in breaking down. I'm not exactly sure that this study is saying how it's doing it, but whether it's that the probiotics are kind of breaking down that oxalate and not allowing it to absorb, or some other function, maybe it's, you know, I don't know if it's the gut barrier integrity, but based on these probiotics, it was able to reduce that absorption of the oxalate in people that had, high oxalate in their bloodstream and in their body, and I believe had kidney stones as well, but not everybody that has oxalate issues has kidney stones.
Great. Well, I'd like to just take a step back because I know we talked about oxalates extensively in the first summit, but for folks who may not have listened to that, can we just give a quick recap of a few foods that may be high in oxalates just so we're aware of it? And we did talk about how these oxalates can cause pain issues and can actually contribute to anxiety and mood problems as well. But let's just go through a few foods. And then I'd like to come back to that strain of good bacteria that you mentioned, but let's talk about the foods first.
Sure. So there's actually a couple ways you can have a problem with oxalates, and one of them is from certain people's biochemistry or their ability to create oxalate internally. But oxalate also comes, as you mentioned, from food, so people might have different reasons for their oxalate issues. And one of those might be that they're eating very high oxalate foods, or because of their issue, they need to eat low oxalate foods. So high oxalates are in things like nuts, particularly almonds are very high. And so this is, again, where I feel very passionately about there is no one diet that works for everybody. And today, there are a lot of grain-free diets. And I love that. I think grains are one of the more problematic foods that a lot of people have trouble with, especially for their digestion. But then you see people using high amounts of almond flour or other nut flours. Almond flour specifically has, just to give you an example, 450 milligrams of oxalate in a quarter of a cup. So somebody in a single serving of nut flour or almond flour, let's say bread or something like that, could be getting 10 times more oxalate than some people can handle in an entire day. So almonds are high, nuts in general are high, beans are high, beets, there are, you know, kiwi fruits, those are some of the ones, sweet potatoes. So again, these aren't all bad foods. Probably one of the biggest ones that most people are familiar with is spinach. Spinach is very high. So spinach has somewhere between, you know, 500 and 1,000 in a serving. So if you think that, you know, a lot of people are doing their best to get calcium-rich foods, they're eating a lot of spinach, they're getting some nuts, they're, you know, they're doing these wonderful nutrition principles. But for some people especially, they really have a difficult time with this high level of oxalate that really can affect their gut. Like you said, it can then affect a whole cascade of other things, including mood and anxiety.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. And
sure.
As we heard last time, I have discovered I've got an issue with oxalates, and I discovered that kiwi fruit really is high in oxalates by mistake one time.
Unfortunately, so, the hard way.
Yeah, you find out the hard way. So I'm glad that we just had that little recap there, because it's not an area that a lot of people know a lot about, and I know you're an expert in this area. So I want to go back to the Oxalobacter formigenes. Did I pronounce that correctly?
That's right.
So imagine if they had a study with the VSL3 plus this form, how much better results they would see. Would you expect to see that?
Yes. In fact, there are some studies, I believe, on the Oxalobacter formigenes. The challenge is that it's not commercially available in the United States. It is commercially available in some other countries, so that's a really good thing. But for us, we don't have that. So, yeah, the studies show very positive results, but the challenge is that not everybody can get it. So since some people can't get it, they use other types of probiotics, and particularly since VSL number 3 was shown to be helpful in the study, that's one that some people tend to use.
Okay, great. You answered my next question was, is it available? So I'm glad to know that. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Well, it's good to hear that the VSL3 seems to be helping as well. Maybe you just need really high doses of some of the others to have some of these effects.
Yeah, it's, you know, it, again, this is why studies are so important. It'd be interesting to know what it is about that. Is it the high dose? Is it something else? Is it a combination of things? But again, I don't want everybody running out and buying VSL number 3. It's got little traces of dairy. Some people don't do well with that. So again, everybody, and you know what? There is too much, in my opinion, there can be too much of a good thing. You know, certain people with SIBO, which we'll talk about in a minute, sometimes too much of a good thing actually causes them challenges. So more is not always better, but it's good to know if somebody's looking at all of their available options, it might be something for them to consider.
Good, and I'm glad you mentioned that. We're talking about a lot of things here, and not everything's going to work for everyone, and we need to figure out what your own biochemistry is and what you're going to need. So, yeah, take this information, realize how beneficial the concept is, and then figure out what might be applicable to you. So thanks for making that clarification.
Sure.
Now, continuing on the probiotics, let's talk about some other types of probiotics that we might see out there.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of probiotics on the market. Typically, what I tend to see most are the freeze-dried probiotics. They're just as the name says, the way that they're preserved or remain in a dormant state is that they freeze-dry them. And so a lot of the kind of the main probiotics that I'm most familiar with, a lot of them use that particular kind of method, and they're those types of probiotics, and they can be lactobacillus strains or bifidobacterium strains. And the nice thing about probiotic supplements is that you can really get very targeted with specific ones. So some people don't do well with strep strains, and so they won't get a probiotic supplement that has those in it maybe, or other people need lactobacillus rhamnosus, which for some people might be better for the skin, like maybe skin conditions and things. So the nice thing about a probiotic supplement is you can very much target the particular strains if there are any strains that you need for any particular condition. Certain ones are known better to help with certain pathogens and things like that. So that makes probiotics nice that you can target very specifically the types of strains that might be best. Some people have an excess of acidity and lactic acid, and so they do better with a D-lactate-free type of a probiotic. Some people don't do well with FOS or inulin-type substances, which we'll talk about when we talk about prebiotics in a moment, and there are some probiotics that are free of those extra prebiotics, basically. And there's also a type of probiotic, the soil-based organisms, or some people call them SBOs. And they're, and again, they're the types of strains that might be isolated from soil at one point in time. And these are not freeze-dried. These are typically dehydrated, so they have a different method. You know, for some people, certain things colonize better. Certain people need and do better with different types. So there are a variety of different probiotics that someone might choose.
Okay, great. And I'm glad you mentioned some of the probiotics that you will find have prebiotics added in with them. And we're going to talk about prebiotics in a second, and that may be problematic for some people. So I'm glad we brought that one up. And I'd love a little bit of more clarification on the D-lactate free. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So there are certain people that for just a variety of different reasons, they might there are certain markers they might look for in their labs, or they have a condition of acidity and lactic acid. A lot of bacteria are lactic acid bacteria. And so some people don't do well with those, so they might choose a different strains of probiotics than somebody else would that are free of those particular lactic acid strains. And so, you know, again, it's going to probably be different, but for instance, Lactobacillus acidophilus would have that is one of those lactic acid versions. So people might do more of like a rhamnosis or a bifido bacteria, you know, something like that. So it's different. It's basically choosing different strains based on that individual need. And somebody's healthcare provider could look at stool tests or other things and determine which probiotic might be particularly helpful. Or if somebody doesn't do well with, say Lactobacillus acidophilus, maybe one of those reasons might be that lactate. And so getting the D-lactate-free might be a good option for them. And there are some companies that make specific D-lactate-free versions.
Okay, very interesting, because there is some research showing that people who have panic attacks have higher levels of lactate, and it would be interesting to see if some of these studies are actually using D-lactate-free probiotics, you know, when they're helping some of the mood problems. Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so we mentioned prebiotics. So let's just talk a little bit about prebiotics. And these are non-digestible foods that actually help the body to make its own good bacteria in the digestive system. Anything else that I need to say in terms of what a prebiotic is?
Yeah, I mean that's pretty much it. It's sort of food for the bacteria. It's carbohydrates that we can't break down that they can break down, and they use that as food, and so that helps them to colonize. And so that's why sometimes probiotic supplements will include some of these prebiotics in there. It sort of includes their food source with them, so that then they wake up, they're able to kind of have their food source there and be able to use it. And so a lot of times, you know, there are some great, a lot of great principles and need for these. In fact, there's Dr. Kelman, who wrote a book called The Microbiome Diet, and he talks a lot about prebiotics and the importance of prebiotics for good gut health, and that is very true. Things like garlic and onion and banana and asparagus and things like that are good sources of these prebiotics, and they help to keep that, they help to create a fermentation environment for these good bacteria. The challenge is they're also they're high in fermentable carbohydrates, or something that we call FODMAPs, a type of fermentable carbohydrate. And this particular type of fermentable carbohydrate is not really tolerated by some people. So you know, when we get in talking about, maybe we'll talk about it next, when we talk about SIBO, or well, maybe I'll just kind of bring it in now. It's small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And it's good bacteria, but good bacteria is supposed to be in a lot higher concentrations in the colon or in the large intestine. When it gets into the small intestine, there's smaller amounts in the small intestine, and the small intestine is smaller. So if you think about it like one of those little balloons, like those little animal balloons they have for kids, if you have too much gas, or you're blowing, you know, gas or air into that balloon, it's going to stretch. And when the walls of that small intestine stretch too much, it can create a lot of discomfort. So the small intestine usually doesn't have large amounts of bacteria. But when we don't have the migrating motor complex that keeps everything moving down, and for whatever combination of reasons, somebody might have too much good bacteria in the wrong place, basically. And when that happens, that good bacteria is going to ferment these fermentable carbohydrates and create gas. And that can cause a lot of discomforts for some people. So for everybody, at some point, certain prebiotics, large amounts of beans, for example, might cause everybody a problem at a certain point. But some people are very sensitive, in part sometimes because of this particular condition. And so that's why we want to just be careful with both too many probiotics or too many prebiotics for certain people. I would say in general it's a really good principle, but I know that even myself, I don't have a problem with really any FODMAP foods. But if I drink chicory root tea, or if I take a probiotic with inulin or something, it creates quite a bit of pain and discomfort for me that other just normal foods like banana or, you know, something like that doesn't necessarily do. So for some people, they want to be careful, or they might just need to choose their probiotic based on their prebiotics.
Okay, good. And this goes back to this whole biochemical individuality, which is so important, or as
exactly.
You call it, bio-individual nutrition. And I just want to recap, because we talked about, you mentioned the garlic and the onion and the asparagus and the bananas. And then I don't know that we mentioned that these, that inulin and chicory were part of this prebiotic list. So just wanted to make
yes.
sure that we
okay,
were clear on
you.
That.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So the ones that you'll typically, so some of them come in food, but the ones you'll typically see in a probiotic formula are either listed as inulin or sometimes FOS, fructooligosaccharides, and those are the ones that you might find in the prebiotic supplements.
Okay.
Or I'm sorry, the probiotic supplements. In fact, they even sell prebiotic supplements. You can buy just a whole capsule of prebiotics. But usually we're talking about the probiotics that will have the prebiotics in it.
Great. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure we had
Thank
that
you.
Clear. No,
yep.
That's good. And then I just wanted to also mention another study that I mentioned in my book, and this was looking at people with irritable bowel syndrome. It was done in 2009. They gave them prebiotics. I don't actually remember which ones they were, but it increased the bifidobacteria, and it reduced the anxiety and the depression, and it also changed their stool consistency and resulted in less bloating. So there are going to be some people that are going to benefit, and then, as
exactly.
you say, there's going to be some people that may have a problem.
Yes, and the reason I mention these things, you know, is because that some, you know, your neighbor or something is going to come and say, oh, this is the best thing that I ever done, this diet or this supplement or this thing is the best thing I ever done, and then you try to do it, and then you feel worse, and then you think, you know, did I do it wrong? Did I not do it well enough? You know, maybe it's not related to that at all. And, you know, so just like to mention these things because, you know, everybody is unique. And, but, you know, you're absolutely right. In general, these are really good things. And a lot of studies show great things about prebiotics. It would only be something to think about if you were having any challenges with that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then a few other prebiotics. Psyllium is a prebiotic, isn't it?
I believe it is as well, yes.
Okay.
And there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, lots of vegetables have prebiotics as well. You know, greens, dandelion greens, leeks, asparagus, those types of things as well.
Okay, great. Let's talk about when you would use foods versus supplements and the pros and cons of one versus the other.
Sure. I think that, you know, they're both good, and some people will include both. Some people, you know, that are, you know, pretty healthy people and their gut is pretty healthy, they might stick with fermented foods because they're easy and they're food and they've got a lot of other good principles. The nice thing about fermented food is that it's a form of food that is already partly digested, so tends to create a little less gas. It also tends to be better digestible, have more access to the nutrients. The good bacteria creates things like vitamin C and other nutrients, so it can be higher in nutrients than the foods themselves that aren't fermented. They can often help with supporting a good pH balance in the gut. So fermented foods have lots of wonderful qualities. The other nice thing about fermented foods is that you can get a lot of bacteria in a serving. So Dr. Joseph Mercola did a tested recently some of his own homemade sauerkraut and found 10 trillion beneficial bacteria in a 4 to 6 ounce serving. So that's 100 times the amount of bacteria in a bottle of a high potency probiotic in a serving. So it is really a great way. So, you know, a lot of people like to do fermented foods, and you can get a lot of good bacteria that way. The thing about probiotic supplements is, as I mentioned earlier, you can really single out the strains that you need. If you most strains of fermented foods contain lactobacillus acidophilus. So if you don't do well with that, those strains of more of the lactic acid type of bacteria, or you're looking for a strain, again, for a particular function or need, then the probiotics are nice. Or maybe you have a child that's kind of a picky eater and you're having trouble figuring out how you're going to get the fermented food in. Or you're working with a nursing mom and a baby and the baby's not going to be chomping on sauerkraut. You know, that might be a time where the probiotics supplements have some particular beneficial use.
Excellent. So we talked a little bit about how fermented foods and probiotics may not be good for someone who has SIBO, the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Can you talk a little bit more about some other people who may have trouble with fermented foods? And I know you talk about this extensively when you do your training in the Bioindividual Nutrition Institute, but can you give us a few little pointers on what we might need to think about?
Absolutely. So firstly about SIBO, some people do better with probiotics and some people do worse. So it's not automatically that you're going to do worse. So just say that up front. But some of the other ones, I mean, there are some diets that are really heavy in fermented foods because they have such wonderful qualities. And like I said, sometimes people will start doing some of these diets and they will end up feeling worse. And so then sometimes it really saddens me sometimes, you know, people will be on these message boards and some, you know, people will jump on their case saying, oh, you must be doing the diet wrong then because, you know, these are all wonderful principles. And the reality is that because everybody is unique and different, they may not all do well with fermented foods or even sometimes probiotics as well. So fermented foods contain high levels of amines. One of those amines is called histamines, and also very high in glutamates. So I actually heard a man speak at a Weston A. Price conference once, and he actually has so sensitive to glutamate that when he would eat fermented foods, he would actually get a seizure. So that's an extreme example. So that is, I've never ever heard that before other than him. But just to give you an example, amines and glutamates, they have to be processed by a couple things. An MAO enzyme, which some people don't have functioning ideally well, and also through a sulfation pathway. So I won't go into all the chemistry, but there are some people that, you know, in certain biochemical pathways in certain people that aren't ideally functioning, that for them, when they consume fermented foods, they can create headaches, irritability, flushing, you know, just a lot of negative symptoms for them. And that could be the amines and the glutamates that are in there. And it just turns out that children with autism often have a lot of challenges with some of those biochemical pathways. Again, many of them do very, very well with fermented foods, and it's one of the very things that they definitely need because they need to work on that gut and balance that gut back out again. But if someone were consuming these foods and they weren't doing well, or they were seeing symptoms, and you know, they might just be, you know, suspect or be a little suspicious, could it be the amines or the glutamate? So people that react to other amines or things like red wine, chocolate, cheese, you know, aged cheeses, bananas, those are all high in amines. So if somebody reacted to those, they might be a little careful of fermented foods. Glutamates are high in, of course, MSG, but also soy sauce and Parmesan, or my friends down in Australia, Vegemite. And so, if someone reacted to those types of foods, those are glutamate foods, and they also might not do so well with fermented foods because ferments break down the foods, break down the amino acids, and release the amines and the free glutamate. And so that's one of the ways some people have trouble with fermented foods. There's a couple other ways. You know, there are bacterial ferments and there are yeast ferments. So yogurt is a bacterial ferment, like we talked about some of the bacterias that are in there. But something like kefir or kefir or kombucha, they contain good beneficial bacteria, but they also contain beneficial yeast. But some people, you know, maybe based on their immune system, they're overreactive to these yeast. And even the friendly yeast, they're creating these immune system reactions to. So some people don't handle yeast ferments very well. And they might need to stick with the bacterial ferments or something like that. Other people, I've actually heard, I had a client once, and there's actually the possibility, believe it or not, that you can have an immune system or allergic reaction to the flagellum. It's like the little motor of the bacteria. So people can actually also be reacting, their immune system can react to the probiotics, the good bacteria as well. And so some people might have immune reactions to them as well. It's very rare. I've only heard of one client that ever had, maybe one or two that ever had that. You know, maybe people with more extreme immune system reactions, it's possible. So again, I would say that for the vast majority of people, they do well with fermented foods. They do well with probiotics. It's often one of the things that they very much need. But if somebody were consuming them and they thought, you know, I don't know why I'm feeling worse, or I don't know why I'm not feeling better, and, you know, they start to suspect that maybe there's something with those, you know, there might really be something to that. They might want to listen to that, their body, and consider maybe what they need to do. I'm not a person that says, well, then just avoid fermented foods your whole life because we need that good bacteria, but maybe they want to work on building up certain nutrient deficiencies. Maybe they want to figure out what pathways are deficient and try to do some supplementation to support it so that they are able to go back and hopefully consume some of these because they're so good.
Wonderful. And that's so interesting about the immune reaction to the good bacteria. And
yes.
A follow-up question on the ones that, like the kefir and the kombucha, that contain the yeast as well as the good bacteria. Would this be an issue with someone who may have candida?
Yes, I believe so. Because at least this is my theory, or what I've kind of seen, is that if you're reacting to yeast, candida is a pathogenic yeast versus some of these other beneficial yeasts. But if the body is maybe having trouble fighting it off and it's constantly being exposed to it, the immune system is constantly going off saying, there's a yeast invader, there's a yeast invader, let's get it, let's get it, let's get it. And then it's very possible that the good yeasts, it might be overreacting to them, not realizing that they're friend, not foe. At least that's been my experience. So I do think that, again, sometimes ferments and yeast ferments are the exact thing that people with candida benefit from, because the good yeast helps to combat the bad yeast. But I have seen a few, you know, a smaller number of people where it does seem that they're reacting, and that's my suspicion of why.
Okay, great. So this is a matter of seeing what your reaction is and adjusting if you need to. So no one
right.
size fits all.
Exactly.
Got it. Good, good. Now, I'd love to just go into a little bit about making fermented foods, and I'm really excited that you're going to share this part, because I want to just share that Julie does these wonderful classes. She's got a wonderful DVD where she teaches how to make some of these wonderful foods and other really nourishing, nutrient-dense foods for people with some of these challenges. And she did this amazing live class down in San Francisco, and I live in Sacramento. And I went down to her class and did a class on how to make raw sauerkraut. And it was absolutely fantastic. It was just so wonderful to be part of it and to see how easy it is, and to walk away with this wonderful product. We walked away with some other great ferments as well. But Julie's going to share with us a little bit about, you know, how you could conceivably make your own sauerkraut if you wanted to do that and get these beautiful good bacteria into the diet. But before we go into the raw sauerkraut, just tell us why we might want to think about making our own fermented foods.
Sure. Well, it's a lot less expensive. So when I did the math on it, it's about one-tenth the price to make your own. So it's really cost-effective. So that's one reason. The other thing is that you can make it with ingredients either that you enjoy more or with ingredients that you tolerate. So sometimes I work with people that have a lot of food intolerances and they can't handle a lot of different things, or, you know, maybe they're trying to keep the oxalates low so they don't want to do the sauerkrauts with the beets or whatever it is. So you can, the other nice thing is it's very flexible and you can use the ingredients that you tolerate and the ingredients that you like and you want in there. You can also ferment it to the level that you want to. So for example, kombucha, if you ferment it not long enough, it's sweet, and if you ferment it too long, it's vinegar. And, you know, with maybe a child, maybe you just ferment it just a tiny bit less, so it's a little bit on the sweeter side rather than the more vinegar side. Then you don't have to add fruit juice or something else to it. So you can ferment it to the level you want. Or, you know, sometimes you, with a yogurt, for example, maybe you, for example, with like a specific carbohydrate or a GAPS diet, you want to make homemade yogurt and you want to ferment it for 24 hours to make sure all the lactose gets fermented out. And you want to avoid the additives and the thickeners and things that are in the yogurt. So by making your own, it's not only much more cost effective, but you can really tailor it to exactly your needs.
Love it. And the other great thing is if you're making something like sauerkraut or anything that you're making on your own, it's local. It's in season. You know,
yes.
It's homemade. You know exactly what's going into it, which I think is so powerful.
Exactly. And that's actually one of the things I like about making my own sauerkraut, is that you don't actually need a culture starter. Some probiotics and some fermented foods, you need a culture starter. But I love the fact that you're really totally self-sustainable and you can get a head of cabbage and you can literally make your own sauerkraut with nothing but a head of cabbage and a little bit of salt. And so it's not something you need anything special for. I mean, there is some special equipment if you want to buy it, but you don't need to, and you don't need anything extra. And I really like that sort of sustainability and sort of personal, you know, take charge of your own personal situation, which I think is fun.
So let's talk about sauerkraut.
What would
we do? Let's just give a high level. I know that we can
go
into it in a lot more detail, but let's just give a high level to get people inspired here.
Absolutely. And I'm going to share a video with them as well so they can get much more of the details of it. There are two ways that you can do it. Again, you can do it with a starter or without. I'm going to talk about doing it without a starter for the reasons I just mentioned. I tend to use mostly cabbage. So I tend to use probably about 75% cabbage, and then I might add other vegetables to it. This way I know that there's enough lactobacillus it's naturally on the cabbage. If you make it with certain other vegetables, let's say, butternut squash or 100% carrots, it might get a little bit slimy or something if you don't have a starter. So I tend to, if I use cabbage, I know it's always going to be successful. So I tend to use about 75% or so cabbage. Then I might add some carrots or some ginger or some beets or some greens or some seaweed or something else in there, depending on what flavor I like it. And then the secret to making it is to make sure you inhibit mold growth. That is, if you inhibit mold growth, then that's all you really need to do. The bacteria does all the rest. So the way you do that is you use salt. Salt will inhibit the mold growth, and you use water. If you completely submerge it under water, mold can't grow, and only the bits that come and float up to the top will mold. So you want to just scrape all those little bits off and make sure they're not there. So you need some way of keeping it submerged under the water, and that's why they do make special, you know, crocks and different jars and things, and I'll share some of those different containers you might think about. But you could literally use a mason jar with another type of a jar on top if you can push the sour. As anything you can do, or a crock with a plate on top of it, anything you can do where you can push the cabbage underneath the water line and keep it there with some sort of a weight for a period of time, for a couple weeks to a couple months. You ferment it on the countertop. You want to put something over the top, like a cloth or something, just make sure bugs or something don't get in. And that's pretty much all you need: salt, water, and some sort of a container that will, you know, help you accomplish all of those pieces, and that's all you need. Then you leave it on your counter. In a cool spot is better, something that's not too sunny, but that's about all you need, and then nature does all the rest. Once you see, lactobacillus is a lactic acid bacteria. It's acidic, and so pathogens can't really grow. Not only mold, but other bacterial pathogens can't grow in that environment either. So some people will use a little bit of their sauerkraut starter from their other batch. So sometimes I'll make a batch, I'll take it all out, I'll what I call harvest it or put it in jars and put it in my refrigerator when I'm ready, you know, when it's done. And then maybe I'll use a little bit leftover from my last batch and mix it in with my new batch. That way I'm not using any sort of a fancy starter, but I'm starting it off in the right direction. Many times I don't actually do that, so people don't need to do that. But if you're new and, you know, maybe you just want to kind of kickstart it in the right direction, then using a little bit of a current batch will kind of get that going. And once it gets going, then it's all set on its own.
Wonderful. And as you mentioned, you've got a giveaway for folks to sign up to get access to a video where you're going to show people how to make their own homemade sauerkraut.
Absolutely. It's from my cooking course that you were talking about. My cooking course is also on DVD, and there's a cookbook and everything associated with lots of other types of recipes as well. So people will basically get that video from the course. I'm going to give it to everybody as just a free gift for them if they're interested in learning more.
Well, thank you for doing that. And I know the recipes in the Cooking to Heal DVD and book are fabulous, and there's other cultured vegetables in there. You talk about, you know, how to make coconut kefir and kombucha and some of the the water-based kefir soda. So it's going to be a great, start for people to get inspired and want to try and make their own ferments.
Absolutely. And it's not hard at all, but sometimes it's nice to have someone hold your hand the first time. Mm-hmm. So by seeing somebody else do it, it can just demystify it a bit and make it fun. So
yes, it really does. And going down to the in-person cooking class that you did, where we did it in person, it was good. You could see what it's supposed to look like. You could, you know, try it out and feel comfortable with it, because it feels like it's a little bit of a big project initially, but once you do it once and you see someone do it, which you will see in the video, it's going to make a lot more sense, and it's going to be a lot easier than you think.
Right. It's a little bit weird to consider doing a science experiment where you're growing bacteria on your counter. So it's nice to just know a few of the tips to get it started in the right direction.
Exactly. And some of these ferments look a little bit weird, so feeling comfortable with how they're going to look and hearing, you know, an expert share the information is definitely going to give you a bigger level of comfort, which is what we want.
And if someone has an opportunity to try real, live, raw sauerkraut, you know, even if it's a store-bought brand, but it's in the refrigerated section, it's got the live cultures we talked about, it's not pasteurized, they'll get a real sense of what it's supposed to look like and smell like. You know pretty well if your sauerkraut's gone the wrong direction. And if you've tried it, you kind of know what you're shooting for. So it also is very helpful.
Good. And that's a good point, because we don't want to be buying the store-bought sauerkraut that's sitting, you know, in the non-refrigerated section, because that's not the real deal.
Exactly. And then in terms of containers, I won't go into too much, but, you know, there's a few brands. I mean, there's like just a regular ceramic crock, or you can – there's a really cool – one of the ones I have is a harsh crock, and that's another kind of fancy ceramic crock. But then there's also picklet jars, and there's a new cool invention that just came out from a colleague and friend, and hers is called Kraut Source, and she's actually in the process of making that right now, and so that's a really nice one too. So you can spend anything from, you know, $20 to $200 or nothing, and you know, have some sort of a container to use.
Yep, and that's a good point. You can get fancy gear or make the basics, and I just got a big crock pot and then put a plate over it and filled a big Coke bottle with water, and that was my weight that held it under, and that to me is the only use for a Coke bottle.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So anything works. You don't have to get all the fancy stuff. But I like the idea of trying it out first, seeing if you like it. And we do want to just mention, if you did have sauerkraut, you're not going to have a mountain on your plate. It's a small condiment serving size. We didn't mention that. So it's just a small amount that you would want to have, correct?
Yeah, especially when you're first starting out. Now, the serving size that on Mercola's study, that was 4 to 6 ounces. So that's a much larger serving size than somebody else might do. But when you're starting, I mean, even small amounts of these things, you know, every day or a couple times a day or something, just condiment size is also good. So just start where you are with what you like, and that'll be a good place to start.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for offering that great video. So we'll make sure that the link to get the video is on the replay page and on the blog. And this is going to be this video on making sauerkraut. And then you've got another gift for practitioners. And this might be for people who would be interested in the Bioindividual Nutrition Institute. So could you just share what that gift is and then a little bit about the Bioindividual Nutrition Institute?
Sure. So for practitioners that are interested in some of the things I was talking about today, they might be interested in our institute. It's called the Bioindividual Nutrition Institute. And the gift that I want to share with you is a talk that I did on the importance of personalizing diet in your practice. So we have about 100 people in our institute at this point. We have doctors, we have nutrition consultants, we have all sorts of people with different backgrounds. Anybody that's using nutrition in their practice would be interested in these approaches that I'm talking about. I talk about 12 different diets. I go into a lot of the things that I was talking about today in terms of how do you individualize this? How do you figure out the types of symptoms that might cause certain reactions and the types of foods that are related to those and all of that, so that people can really help individualize a diet, because as we said, everybody is unique and different. Everybody has unique biochemistry, and one diet is not going to work for everybody. And so this way you can really learn some of the I guess you'll get a kind of an idea of some of the gems and some of the pieces that you can start and use in your practice right away, and then get a better sense of the institute and the types of things that we teach there. So I'm going to make that available to all the practitioners along with the sauerkraut video. So if there'll be two different links if you want both of those, or depending on what you're interested in.
great. Well, thanks for doing that as well. And I do want to just mention you just finishing up the live training in the Bioindividual Nutrition Institute, and then that material is going to be available as a home study version that you can do at any time. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So there's two courses, actually. The first course is 12 weeks, and it goes into all the different special diets, low oxalate, low phenol, low FODMAPs, SCD, GAPS, GFC, all, you know, you name ketogenic, you name it, and we go into depth on, you know, how to use it, when to use it, what the studies say, what types of conditions, all these types of things. I put a lot of science in there, as well as the practical how to implement and how to help your clients and patients implement it. And then the second course is very specifically on my passion, which is autism and kids' nutrition, ADHD, and other developmental delays and other conditions like that. So people can, and that's an add-on course. So the first course adds on to the second course for those people that are interested in that particular specialty.
Okay, great. And I know you've got some software that goes with this that makes it a lot easier. And I know you're going to be talking about fermented foods and probiotics in both of these courses. So what we've covered today is a nice preview to, you know, Julie's expertise and knowledge on the subject.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thanks, Julie, so much for being here. This has been really fantastic. I knew you wouldn't disappoint. Lots of research, lots of practical information. I'm just feeling like going and having some yummy sauerkraut right now or some nice
Me too.
Yogurt. Any final words of wisdom before we end?
You know, I think if you're on a journey to wellness like most human beings hopefully are, that you know, just starting where you are and taking one step at a time. And fermented foods are a nice, easy thing that all of us can do. You know, we all need to eat food. It's accessible. It's available. We can buy it in the store. We can make it ourselves. And it's helpful just from the bottom up. So it's helpful from the gut and everything that's related, you know, from there on. So I think it's a really nice, easy first step that people can take. So I, you know, wish everybody well on their journey to nourishing hope, and hope to see them sometime soon.
Great. Thanks so much, Julie. It's been really a pleasure having you again. And thanks for the wonderful gifts. And I look forward to everyone hearing this, and I look forward to everyone joining us on some other great interviews on the Anxiety Summit. This has been a fabulous call, and this is Trudy Scott signing off.